average New Yorker lives to be about 80 years old, slightly longer than most Americans. So when someone even a bit younger dies, it raises eyebrows. This month, we had two high-profile deaths. First, Kate Spade died. She was 55 years old. Then Anthony Bourdain. He was 61. They both died by suicide, but suffered from mental health illnesses. We know about them because they were famous, but they were not the only ones suffering. And here's where we have to clarify a key point. Despite what it may seem like, people with mental health illnesses do not always die by suicide, and yet they are dying at a much younger age than everyone else. According to recent research, people struggling with mental health issues may be dying 15 to 30 years before most people. Some doctors now believe this trend indicates a gap in how we treat chronic medical conditions in people who are mentally ill. Dhruv Kular is a physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital and a researcher at Weill Cornell Medical Center. Dr. Kular recently published an article in the New York Times Upshot titled, "The Largest Health Disparity We Don't Talk About." It looks at the causes of this dramatic difference in life expectancy and suggests ways to improve it. Dr. Kular, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
Now, for anyone listening right now, I'm asking you, have you or someone close to you struggled with mental health issues as well as physical health problems? If so, what tools and tactics have you used to make sure that you or your loved ones receive the best, most comprehensive care possible? What issues did you encounter? Were you able to find a comprehensive approach to care from the physical body to the mind? Call us at 212-433-9692 or tweet us at WNYC Midday. So Dr. Kular, your article was fascinating. What are some of the most common causes of these deaths?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on to talk about this really important issue that I think doesn't get enough discussion. And so as you mentioned, Americans who have serious mental illnesses, depression, bipolar disorder, some anxiety disorders, the disparity between how long they live as compared to people without mental health issues can be on the order of decades. And there are a number of reasons for this that I wanted to highlight in the article. And I think it's helpful to talk about this disparity in terms of three different buckets that I think really contribute to the disparities we see. The first is environmental issues. So we know that people with serious mental illness are much more likely to struggle with things like homelessness, with poverty, with social isolation. All those things are very strongly correlated with having a lower life expectancy. The second bucket, I would say, is behavioral issues, the kind of behavioral aspects of health. So people with mental health issues often have higher rates of obesity, have higher rates of physical inactivity, or higher rates of tobacco use. And the final thing, as a doctor, which I was really interested in, and the point that I want to make, is the third bucket is a clinical bucket. You know, once patients come to clinics, once they come to hospitals, it's not always clear that they get the same care as everyone else. And part of that is we often focus too narrowly on their mental health issues, and we ignore some of the chronic conditions that they struggle with as well, things like heart disease and diabetes, cancers. And so that's one of the big points that I wanted to make in this article.
So what I'm hearing is that there are three areas where people who suffer from mental illnesses may not be receiving the best sort of care or treatment. We have sort of behavioral, we have environmental, and also clinical issues that may contribute to the deaths of people with mental illness aside from the mental health issues. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. And, you know, each of those kind of buckets, I think, require different possible solutions. But one that I think is in all of our control right now is the clinical bucket. You know, I think doctors, I think loved ones of patients with mental illness, patients with mental illness themselves, once they're in the healthcare setting, we can all do more to advocate to make sure that they get the same types of care for their chronic medical conditions, in addition to the very important care that they need to receive for their mental health conditions.
So, doctor, I have colleagues, friends, loved ones who have suffered from mental health illnesses. And one of the things that they tell me is that often they're not believed when they go into doctors' offices, or that doctors discount what they're saying. Now, you write about something called therapeutic pessimism. What is that?
That's right. So there's two related concepts here. One is therapeutic pessimism, as you mentioned. And that's basically the idea that we have pretty gloomy views about whether patients with mental illness can get better. And that leads us to be a bit passive about the way that we treat them, so that they may not get the same tests and treatments because we don't think that they're going to help. And that's something that we really need to start pushing back against, because with the right treatment, many of these patients can actually get much better. But the second concept that is kind of closely related to therapeutic pessimism is this idea of diagnostic overshadowing. And that basically means that when people with mental illness come to a doctor and they are talking about the physical symptoms that they have, they might be feeling pains in their chest, they may be having a headache, they may be having abdominal pain, there's a tendency among doctors to attribute those physical symptoms to their mental illness, and to not think that it's a real kind of organic illness that has a physical cause. And that can also lead to a lot of problems. And one of the points that I wanted to highlight in the article as well is there's a doctor, Dr. Brendan Riley, who's at Dartmouth now, and he wrote a beautiful article about how this comes to pass with his brother, who actually passed away recently. And his brother had a serious mental illness, was in hospitals, was in rehab facilities, was in clinics, and his spinal cord damage actually was missed by all these members of the medical team because they thought it was so related to his mental illness. So it can have really problematic ramifications.
So it's so difficult to believe. So he had an illness that could have been diagnosed, a physical illness, spinal cord illness, and yet because he suffered from mental health injuries, they didn't think to look at that, or they discounted that? Am I hearing that correctly?
That's right. And it was a rare case, but it's a really devastating story in that he was complaining of an inability to move, or he wasn't moving, getting up and walking like he used to. And that inability to move was ascribed either to his mental illness, to some of the medications that he was taking, maybe there were side effects of that, or maybe he just didn't want to. And ultimately, it took them months to realize that he actually had some spinal cord damage. And that's a very stark example and a really horrific one. But these types of things happen on a smaller scale every day that aren't quite as dramatic. So people who have mental illness, they are less likely to get stents when they go to a hospital if they have signs of a heart attack symptoms. They're less likely to get standard blood tests or eye exams for their diabetes. They're less likely to get screened and treated for cancer. So all across the spectrum, in ways big and ways small, they're not getting the same care for their physical symptoms because they have a mental illness.
Our phone lines are blowing up right now because people want to ask you questions and share their stories. I want to turn to Paul in New Jersey. Right. Now, he's struggled to find appropriate care. Paul, are you with us?
I am with you.
What's your story?
Geez, my story is a long one. So I've been in therapy since I was 11 years old, and I'm 59. And so I go way back in terms of when it was, you know, really difficult to get the appropriate care. But what I really want to address with you guys is that my most recent, like, 5 years, I'm with a therapist and an actual psychiatrist. And, you know, I read about this and hear it online with you guys. I'm on a lot of medications, and I think that's a real problem these days. I've been put on some heavy-duty medications that then my system gets addicted to, and I was with some doctors that didn't. I would ask about, well, am I going to be on these for the rest of my life? I mean, I feel like I'm catatonic most of the time. And I have finally, after a long search, been able to connect with a psychiatrist who is gently weaning me off medications. I mean, I'm free to...
How did you find your psychiatrist?
Well, online. And I went to... So it was the therapist... Excuse me, not online. The therapist that I was with finally the two doctors, I was with one psychiatrist who did not want to hear me talk about getting off. The therapist said, you know what, I now see your point. Here's a doctor that I've heard good news about. And I've been with him for about 6 months. And, I mean, I'll tell you, doctor, I mean, I'm on Depakote. I'm on Neurontin, heavy dosages, and I'm on Wellbutrin, Trazodone. So as you would probably know, those are, you know, those affect my, you know, my ability to sleep, my ability to focus. And that alone has added to, you know, so, and I'm on Wellbutrin, but with all these other medications, I still feel very depressed because I'm on all these medications. And, you know, sometimes I get depressed because I don't see a way out. It's not the way I pictured my life.
Thank you so much, Paul. So, Dr. Kular, is this an experience that resonates with the recent findings of these studies?
Absolutely, and I want to thank Paul for sharing his story. You know, his experience highlights two really important issues. The first is that often people with mental illness are treated primarily with medications and not enough with what we call talk therapy or talking through using things like cognitive behavioral therapy and other forms of counseling. And so I think often we overemphasize the use of medications and underemphasize the use of talk therapy, which can be really problematic. But the second point on this is that many of these psychiatric medications have a lot of side effects that make it difficult for people to continue to take them, but they also have side effects that contribute to chronic disease.
And so when you say side effects, you mean physical side effects, things that are affecting their daily lives.
Absolutely. So there are both physical and mental side effects. So some of these medications themselves can cause things like worsening depression or suicidal ideation. But to Paul's point, there's a lot of physical side effects, so inability to focus. Many people report weight gain, so they put on weight, which, as we know, contributes to obesity and diabetes. People can have difficulty sleeping. People can have sexual side effects. And so there's a lot of really troublesome side effects that come along with these psychiatric medications that are a big part of the problem. So, I want to thank Paul for highlighting that issue.
Drew, there are social media lines are lighting up, and people want to know a little more clearly, what are some of the conditions that people with mental illness are more likely not to be treated or screened for?
Sure. So a few of the things that I mentioned in the article, but they are most chronic conditions that we think about. So things like diabetes, which affect millions of Americans across the country. People with mental illness are less likely to get standard screening. They're less likely to get blood tests and eye exams when they are known to have diabetes. A really important area is screening for cancer. So people with mental illness may be less likely to get things like colonoscopies or prostate exams, mammograms. So those are things that, you know, we should all be paying more attention to. And then the final area is around heart disease. So people who present with heart attack symptoms or they're having worsening shortness of breath when they are moving around, they may be less likely to get things like cardiac catheterization or stress tests. So it really runs the gamut. But things that I would really encourage everyone to focus on are screening for cancer, screening for diabetes, and screening for heart disease.
Fascinating. We're going to take a brief break. I'm Duarte Geraldino, and I'm speaking with Dr. Dhruv Kular. He is a physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital and researcher at the Weill Cornell Department of Healthcare Policy. We'll be right back. And welcome back. I'm Duarte Geraldino, and I'm talking with Dr. Dhruv Kular. He's a physician at the New York Presbyterian Hospital and a researcher at the Weill Cornell Department of Healthcare Policy. And we're talking about why people with mental illnesses are dying at a much higher rate because of issues unrelated to their mental illness. So, Dhruv, you write, Americans with depression, bipolar disorder, or other serious mental illnesses die 15 to 30 years younger than those without mental illness, a disparity larger than for race, ethnicity, geography, or even socioeconomic status. Now, we know that race and class are determining factors in both access to mental health care and biases faced in the exam room. So how can one cause be extricated from the others?
Yeah, so it is. It's really hard to tease out what exactly is the biggest contributors to this disparity. We talked about kind of three large buckets: behavioral issues, environmental issues, and clinical issues. But I think one thing that I want to drive home for everyone is that it's really important, and we're having more and more conversations about mental illness in this country. But many of our conversations, they occur after either a mass shooting has occurred, a tragic shooting, or the suicide of a celebrity. And we had two tragic suicides in the last week or so. But what is actually much more likely to cause people to have shorter lives with mental illness is not any of those things. It's not suicide. It's not overdoses. It's not accidents. It is the same things that everyone else dies from. It's just much earlier on. So things like cancer, heart disease, stroke, diabetes. And I think it's really important that when we're thinking about how better to care for people with mental health issues, be it depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, we're thinking about treating their mental illness, but we're also thinking about treating their physical symptoms and their physical conditions.
So would you say that there's a disconnect between their medical team, between the folks who are treating their mental illness and the ones who are treating their physical illness, just so that I can get the idea as clearly as possible, because some people are listening and wondering, what is going on?
Right. So, you know, we have done something in this country in that we have separated mental health from physical health, and that has a lot of problems and a lot of downstream effects. And so people have to go to different places to get their mental health and their physical health care. Mental and physical health care are paid for very differently. Some things are covered by one insurer. Other things are not covered. And so one thing that I think would be really helpful is a push towards more collaborative care, by which I mean when you go to your primary care doctor, there's also a behavioral health specialist there. There's a mental health professional there or psychiatrist. And so we are treating both mental and physical health in the same physical location, but also the doctors that are treating both these conditions, they are in close communication with each other. So the more that we can treat mental health like physical health, at least in this dimension, I think the better. We're doing all sorts of things to try to improve care for people with diabetes or with knee problems or with hip replacements. And those efforts haven't made their way to mental illness yet, unfortunately.
We have a caller who's on the phone, Brian. Now, he works in the health field, and he has a recommendation for what people working in the field can do to help. Brian, are you with us?
Yes.
So what's your suggestion?
Well, like I said, I've worked in mental health for 20 years, 12 years as a supervisor, and mostly in residential settings where you have a lot of people with their bachelors or even less who are case managers who go out to where these people live with like psychiatric disability. They're usually on, you know, they're on federal disability for the most part, and they have subsidized housing. And we just saw, and I saw that, you know, the focus is on mental health, and these workers who go out are trained to look at their mental health, count their meds and mental health, make sure they're taking them. And like 80% of the people who have these, you know, psychiatric problems have diabetes, high blood pressure. And I've seen people who have literally died from diabetes, you know, sugar shock. Not sure what it's called, because none of us were trained to look for, because we see them kind of every day, none of the staff was trained to look for any kind of physical symptoms. It was just kind of like, okay, you know, make sure you're seeing your doctor. But this guy did have symptoms that none of us really knew to look for. And after this happened, and some, you know, I've seen other situations similar where people have died of physical causes, and not to put the onus on the residencies, but it really would have helped. And we changed our system where we started looking at all their physical conditions when they came in, and we put an emphasis on making sure they made all their physical appointments as well, because it, you know, in taking like he said, the doctor said, a collaborative and a holistic approach, because, you know, it was we were just constantly seeing people come in with physical conditions severe, you know, life-threatening physical conditions, which could be life-threatening, that really weren't being emphasized at all by this type of setting, clinics, day programs, and residential settings.
Brian, fascinating point. So, Dr. Kular, what's your reaction to that? That sometimes that not necessarily the doctors, but everyone else on that team is not trained to spot some of these physical conditions. Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, it's a really great point and a really big problem. And I think, you know, what we have seen in medicine generally is that we fragmented healthcare into so many specialties and subspecialties. And so we've siloed the system in a way that, you know, the cardiologist only looks at the heart and a neurologist only looks at the brain and the gastroenterologist only looks at the GI tract. And that kind of silo is even greater between all the kind of physical health doctors and the mental health doctors. And so the more that we're able to create collaborations between the doctors as well as their teams, I think the better off that patients will be. And there are some places around the country that are starting to try to do more of that when they have an intake or when they're going out to patients' homes to help them within their home. They're taking both a medical history and a mental health history. But Brian's absolutely right in that we have not been doing that traditionally, and we could use a lot more of it.
So you write about this collaborative care model. How widely spread is it?
It is not yet as widely spread as it should be. I think it's a budding model that people are trying to proliferate around the country, by which they have both a mental health specialist and a physical health specialist within the same organization and within the same building, perhaps. You know, there's another initiative that I highlighted in the article that I think is very interesting, and that is what is called a transitional clinic for patients who are discharged from the hospital. So we do this with heart failure patients or heart attack patients all the time. When you're admitted with a heart attack and you leave the hospital, within a week or 10 days, most patients are to be seen in a specialized clinic for heart attack patients or for heart failure patients. We don't do anything like that for patients with psychiatric disease or mental health issues. Patients can wait months to see a mental health professional, and sometimes they don't see one at all. And so in San Antonio, the hospital system, UT Health San Antonio, has created a transitional clinic that's very similar for patients with mental illness. If they present to an emergency department or a hospital and they have a psychiatric issue, after they leave, the goal is to see those patients in a clinic within days. And they meet with a psychiatrist, they meet with social workers, they meet with therapists, they get home visits from care managers and nurses. And those case managers and those nurses, they help patients with their psychiatric drugs, but they also help them with their cholesterol medications and their blood pressure medications, which I think makes a big difference. And they've seen some really impressive results with this type of a clinic in San Antonio.
You mentioned also that some patients require what you call whole person care. Can you define that term?
Whole person care, I think, is not siloing the body into systems, not siloing it into a heart and a GI tract and the lungs and mental health, and talking about all the diseases or the illnesses that people have in separate buckets. It's recognizing that people have illnesses, and those illnesses manifest in ways that consume many parts of their body, and that unless we talk about how everything is related with one another and treat people holistically, they won't get the type of care and potentially won't improve in the way that they had hoped. And so that's what I mean by holistic or whole person care.
Talking with you, I get the impression that so often we look at people with mental illness as just folks with mental illness and not people who are much more complex, who have much more complex health issues and also much more complex lives. And that's sort of a fault of everyone at this point.
That's right. And I think we don't often talk enough about how mental health affects your physical health and how physical health affects your mental health. So it's very hard to manage someone's diabetes or their heart disease or stroke if they are going through significant mental health problems. But the opposite is true as well. A lot of people struggle with pain issues and other physical symptoms that are a manifestation of their mental illness. And so we need to recognize that both are related with one another, both affect one another, and we're not able to really care for either one without caring for the other one.
So, Dr. Kular, we have Julie on the phone. She called in, and she has some experience which really highlights some of the points that you're making. Julie, welcome.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I can't tell you how much I appreciate this discussion. It goes to the heart of what I've been trying to advocate for a very long time.
What is
that? Over the past 5 years, I have been my daughter's facilitator of care. What started out as physical issues, chronic appendicitis, then became chronic pain, which developed into both anxiety and a major depressive disorder. She ended up with suicide ideation, 2 hospitalizations. I'm happy to say, via group therapy, individual, and psychiatry that tested for metabolization of drugs, we cut out a lot of that trial and error, and it has made all the difference. I have my child back, but it was only because of an integrated approach, understanding the playoff between physical and mental symptoms. You can't separate them. They are integrated, and they should be treated that way. More importantly, I really advocate for a mental health wellness visit, just like you have a regular physical visit. They should not be combined. You should have a mental health GP, even though in the HMO world, GPs, that's a whole other discussion.
Fascinating.
Bottom line is there needs to be integration, and there needs to be an acceptance that now with genetic improvements that we have, it's only getting better. You can find out, in my daughter's case, she could not metabolize some of these first intervention medications, and that caused 2 hospitalizations unnecessarily.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing your story. You had one more point, and what else happened?
No, that's pretty much it. I wholeheartedly applaud your efforts, this show, and the doctor's approach to treating the whole patient.
She has her daughter back, but a lot of people don't have their loved ones back because they're lost in the system. Dr. Kular, how do you respond to that, this whole notion that someone who is ill mentally then has to be his or her own advocate, and sometimes that's uniquely challenging?
That's right, I'm so happy that Julie's daughter is doing better now, but you're right that so many people don't have that opportunity and don't have that advocate who gets them through a really difficult experience. And, I think what really inspired me to write this article is, obviously the statistics are powerful and the disparities are large, but it is those real human stories. And a patient I saw who was struggling with bipolar disorder, he had tried to take his life once. He had driven his car into a tree once in an episode of mania. But ultimately, the reason that my patient passed away was a heart attack. And I still think back on that experience, and I think about whether I had paid not enough attention to his physical symptoms and I'd let his mental illness overshadow his physical needs, and it still bothers me. And so those types of experiences, I think, ring in my mind. And I think one of the reasons I'm so grateful for the show and for the calls that we've been getting is I think raising awareness about this issue will go a long way, and it will make it so that potentially patients can be their own advocates, potentially loved ones of patients can help them be advocates, and doctors and nurses and social workers also understand that this is going on and that we can do a better job for our patients.
We only have a couple more minutes left for the segment, but there are people who want to know about money. How much is insurance and billing a factor, a deterrent, or helping this case for this whole person care?
Yeah, so it's been unfortunate in the sense that traditionally mental and physical health services have been paid for separately. And so that's created a lot of issues where mental illness is not treated in the same way. It is harder for people to find good behavioral health because it's not compensated or it's not reimbursed at the same rates as a lot of procedures or other types of physical health care. And so financing is a big part of this. And I think we need to advocate for individual patients, but if we were talking on a policy level, we need to advocate for more funding for mental health research so that the medications are more tolerable, and advocate for more funding for accessibility to mental health services. You know, here in New York City, we are relatively lucky in that we do have more availability to people in terms of behavioral health services, but in a lot of other states and a lot of rural areas of the country, that is much less the case. And so money is absolutely part of the puzzle here.
We have one more caller. Lana has an example of how you really struggled with finding care for your loved one. Is that right, Lana?
That's right. My sister, who's in another part of the country, is over 50. She's a single adult. And her situation financially is a big part of her problem. Getting integrated care is like on another planet compared to the problems she deals with in terms of getting, she has a psychiatric disability. Getting that accepted, and with bipolar 1, being able to advocate for herself, again, that's just like another language from anything that would be relevant for her. She needs people to do that for her. And it's a very complicated case. There are issues of compliance as well. But I think single adults who don't have, you know, families with a trust fund are really in particular hazard.
You make such a key point. Single adults with families who don't have trust funds are at a loss right now, because who values their lives enough to advocate for this whole person care? So, Dr. Kular, how do you respond to her concerns, her experience, and her family members dealing with this issue?
That's right. It's such an important point. And I think one issue that this brings up as well is this idea of cultural stigma. And so there's still, even though mental illness is becoming more normalized, there's still a lot of stigma about people coming out about their mental illness and helping people who have mental illnesses, depression, anxiety, bipolar, and the like. And so, you know, when someone breaks a hip or breaks an ankle, we recognize that they're going to be limited in some ways. We recognize that they are in pain, and we want to help in certain ways, and we consider that to be a limitation or a disability for a period of time. But we don't think the same way often about people struggling with mental illness, even if it can be just as debilitating. And so I think a larger cultural shift is needed to recognize how much stigma still exists around mental illness and to try to break down some of those barriers.
Thank you so much for joining us and really bringing this issue to the forefront, because there are so many people who are struggling with issue. Thanks again.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I'm Duarte Geraldino, and I've been speaking with Dr. Dhruv Kular. He's a physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital and a researcher at Weill Cornell Department of Healthcare Policy. We've been speaking about his recent piece for the New York Times Upshot, The Largest Health Disparity We Don't Talk About.